I can barely stand how good that rain sounds. It's like almost too much. All right, compose yourself, Brent Silver. This is Krishnamurti. You must understand the whole of life, not just a little part of it. That is why you must read. That is why you must look at the skies. That's why you must sing and dance and write poems and suffer and understand. For all of that is life. There is no end to education. It's not that you read a book, pass an examination, and finish with education. The whole life, from the moment you're born until the moment you die, is a process of learning. A Dharma friend of mine described characterize a shift in her life when her life moved from a kind of egocentric to dharma-centric life. Yeah, and the association that I have with a dharma-centric life is a life that is prioritizing learning over getting and holding. Yeah. In psychotherapy, so there's a kind of sometimes a problem with called problem with generalization, meaning that we might learn something, have an insight, master a fear, but somehow that growth, that change, that understanding doesn't actually generalize to all spheres of our life. Sometimes it's stress or a certain potent cue that pushes us back into an old pattern or something. And just as with psychotherapy, the Dharma is the same way. We don't always embody our insight, and we try our best, I think, to be really honest about that, rigorously honest about that. Enlightenment is usually defined as our kind of best moment. Yeah. And we could say, Max talked about the verticality and the horizontal, the way enlightenment is described, it prioritizes the depth over the breadth, yeah? And so enlightenment becomes about how, in a sense, to put it in a simple way, how high our highs are. And for me, I'm very interested, maybe more interested, in how low my lows can be. Yeah. How alienated can I become from the truths of non-harming, of love, of awareness? And so we may learn something on the cushion, we may learn something in retreat, and then that actually catalyzes a process of beginning to integrate the insight into more and more spheres of our life, to try to to bring it to life in every corner of our own world. And that means that sometimes We basically we know something, but we don't w that knowing isn't totally there, but we actually have to pretend. We have to act in accord with the insight, even when it feels a little distant. Yeah. So you see something about loving yourself, releasing certain kinds of self-cherishing, self-protection. It's as clear as the rain in this moment or something in this retreat. And then you find yourself in your life and you remember that, but you feel like, do I actually have the power to embody that, to express that, to manifest that? And maybe there's a part of you that doubts it. Can I live that? Yeah. And sometimes there's a way in which we just pretend a little. We like move through the ambivalence to act in a way that's in accord with the understanding, even though that understanding might feel a little thin or a little distant. If I loved myself that deeply, and I knew that then, I had clarity. What would my behavior look like now? Can we try it out? The rubber meets the road in our Dharma practice. The rubber meets the road in our relational lives. Yeah, that thing that we call other people. Yeah. We of course are deeply relational beings. We emerge out of dependence. Like humans, proportionally, I read some primatologists said, like, humans, we proportionally spend like the longest period of our life in childhood, Like lions, they're hunting at 6 months. And I was useless until I was like 23. Yeah. This is Martha Nussbaum. She says, we all begin our lives as helpless babies, dependent on others for comfort, food, and survival itself. And even though we develop a degree of mastery and independence, we always remain alarmingly weak and incomplete, dependent on others and on an uncertain world for whatever we're able to achieve. As we grow, we all develop a wide range of emotions responding to this predicament. Fear that bad things will happen and that we'll be powerless to ward them off. Love for those who help and support us. Grief when a loved one is lost. Hope for good things in the future. Anger when someone else damages something we care about. Our emotional life maps our incompleteness. A creature without any needs would never have reasons for fear or grief or hope or anger. But for that very reason, we're often ashamed of our emotions and the relations of need and dependency bound up with them. Dependency, hunger, longing, desire, that leaves us exposed. And that sense of exposure, of dependence, often ignites in us some measure of control and clinging. And clinging complicates everything. So this is very apparent when we're together as people, and you know, it's like our relationships in other, you know, in groups or with others, it somehow has the effect of amplifying both the wholesomeness of goodness and also our bad habits. Yeah, so groups are kind of like steroids for the kilesas and the paramis, for the habits of greed, aversion, delusion, and also for like all the beautiful qualities of heart. There are conflicting pressures, conflicting evolutionary pressures in the interpersonal world. And so there's a desire to connect, but also a kind of the comparing mind and competition. And so it's sort of like we want to be like others, to cooperate, to make friends, to get along, and also be just a little bit better. Yeah? Just like you. Just a little better. Yeah? Right? Conceit, yeah? Comparison, like that, and also all the evolutionary pressure of like wanting to get along and wanting to be special. How deep does that run? Yeah? And if everyone wants to be special, there's going to be some collisions. Yeah? So the steroids for the like the paramis, it's like there's just in groups, in relationship, in friendship, it's like, how much goodness is there? How much beauty? How many times have I been moved to tears in Sangha? In, you know, it's just meeting with people, just amazing. The kind of beautiful parts of the heart that are evoked. And then how much, like there are certain times and with certain friends, like there actually I'm thinking about one particular little group of friends where it's like a magnet for all of the aversion in me and the kind of harsh speech, and it's like, yeah, it really, yeah, it just sort of activates a certain kilesa. So there's a saying that if you could never meditate, pay attention to your speech. Yeah. And I don't know exactly what's meant by that, but I can feel the way in which my own speech is like a field guide to my defilements. Yeah. That makes sense? Yeah. Like I can just map the places of confusion or aversion, greed in the mind. A friend of mine said, sometimes we think about speech as this kind of mundane kind of thing, but and she's a real, like, yeah, real strong meditator, a very, very deep mind. What she said to me was like, if you pay attention to your speech, it'll change your life. That was like a core practice of hers. And so as we explore, you know, today this dharma in the interpersonal realm, there's some wise counsel just around speech of true, kind, timely, spoken for the benefit. Now, that doesn't mean avoiding all disagreement or something like that. One of my mentors said, he said, like, Matthew, you get confused about there's a difference between being nice and being kind. Yeah? You're being nice. Yeah? Which is not the worst thing, but. But nice always says yes. Kindness says yes and sometimes no. Yeah? And so we're not trying to sanitize speech in such a way that it doesn't permit, you know, difficult conversations, to paint, strong words or something. Sometimes we can kind of, you know, every teaching can be used or misused. Every teaching can be used by goodness or misused by defilement, yeah? So if I'm avoidant, it's like I can easily rationalize not saying something because of wise speech or something, yeah? So we have to look, yeah? And sometimes, you know, it may be important to vent or something. Like, I think we need to be careful with that. Thich Nhat Hanh talked about venting as like rehearsing one's anger. Yeah. Not releasing it. You venting, ventilate, you know, the ideas. But it is actually like, okay, is it deepening the habit of suffering? And we can actually tune in. Like, if I'm like frustrated about something and, you know, talking in kind of some harsh way with, you know, about something, maybe, I'm actually, as I'm doing it, I'm trying to hear the holes in my logic. Yeah. It's like to be convinced by one's venting is dangerous, yeah? But to do it in a way, it's like, oh yeah, there's some energetic process, some kind of release, something happening. I'm like really trying to release something, but then there's also this sense of not being fully taken in by it, yeah? Because in every rant, data gets ignored. Like, you leave something out. Yeah? And it's very kind of sneaky, the way we just, like, we just come, you know, or whatever, we're into it. Da, 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 yeah. And then we realize, like, well, but there is also, and we're just like, meh, I'm just going to leave that to the side. Let me just stay committed here. Yeah? But it's like, you know, it's like, oh yeah, this is not an airtight case here, yeah. And so you just actually sensitize yourself to the holes in the logic. It's because hatred, I've had to learn this like so much as a kind of aversive type, like anger, aversion, hatred. It's like it's never the last word. There's always more to be seen, yeah. The more deeply we look, the more open-heartedness there will be. Sila, Samadhi, Panya, relevant for all of this, the kind of these three clusters of skills, capacities, insights, of ethics, of mind training, of wisdom. And so, yeah, the Buddha's injunction, make of yourself a refuge for all beings. Yeah, make of yourself a refuge for all beings. And what actually makes us trustworthy for another? Well, What makes us untrustworthy is the expressions of our own unconsciousness, and we harm not from awareness but from confusion. This is subtle, right? Because greed feels like this gaping hole. Hatred burns. And delusion feels exactly like the truth. Yeah? Until it doesn't. Yeah? But until it doesn't, it does. Yeah? So, delusion, we can see this kind of confusion. It's often, I often look like for delusion as a kind of rationalization of greed and hatred. Like that's how greed and hatred hide their poison, is through our own deluded kind of rationalization. So it's like we really, it's hard, like how do we see delusion? Yeah. We really want to look like, when am I pulling a fast one? What is this self-deception? Am I rationalizing greed, aversion? Yeah. And so it's amazing how fast it works. Like sometimes we can build like a whole philosophy, like my whole way of life. I could have this elaborate view of what I am and what my mission, all this stuff. And it's like it all bubbled out of a kind of aversive response to something unpleasant that I did not see. And then it becomes my life. Yeah. I live it. We live out the dreams of the defilements in this way. And so to be safe for others, to become more and more trustworthy, to be more and more of a refuge, entails a kind of a path of self-discovery, of knowing more and more of ourselves, of humility, and of open loops of feedback. We just count on others to a certain measure. I was teaching a retreat not long ago, and we sort of like, me and my fellow teachers, we were talking. It was my turn to do a guided meditation, and they sort of like, you know, made a request. You know, they told me what to do. Yeah, which was good. I asked, what should I do? And they told me, and when we got the plan, it's like, all right, I think what's needed is like a certain like concrete, clear instruction around thought and emotion. You please do that. I'm like, yeah, that's right. And then I sat down. I'm like, okay, we've got the plan. And I just started to get kind of quiet. And so I'm like, I'm trying to do what they said, but it's not really working out. And I don't know, you know, I'm kind of just like narrating my own mind, and it culminates with me saying something like, you know, sometimes people say that the mind is like the sky and thoughts and emotions are like clouds, but the thoughts and emotions are also sky. And afterwards, they're both like, what the fuck? You, Matthew. Thus began a feedback session. And so what my co-teacher was like, no, you're teaching, you need to be teaching their mind, not teaching your mind, yeah? And it kind of, the feedback session, it was extended over the next couple days, actually. And it was like, and it was soup, it was like totally playful and serious, yeah? And it was like, okay, I actually, like, to take that in, I have to just take on the willingness, like, oh, not that this is true, but I just actually have to try on, like, maybe I'm not competent, yeah? And just see what that does to the mind and body, yeah? Right? Because the insistence on going all in on, you know, whatever, on like maintaining that ground, you know, it's like the nature of feedback is it robs the ego of its ground. And there's this desperate attempt to reestablish the kind of the footing. And it can be very disorienting. It can run deep. It can be like a sort of deep egoic, like the ego is like, it's layered. And some layers are more, it gets more and more tender. Yeah. More and more tender. And so we practice, as I'll talk about in a few minutes, of actually being willing to experience this, being willing to experience the groundlessness of falling backwards. It's like falling backwards. That's what it's like when the ego is wounded. This is something that we do. It's like an ethical responsibility, I think, you know. It's why we ask, you know, often at retreats, we ask for your understanding, for your forgiveness, for whatever ways we've misconstrued you or been unskillful or caused harm, right? And that's a sincere invitation, a request, you know, for your understanding. And this is to very clearly signal that the loops of feedback are open. They're open. And that's important in maintaining health between a teacher and a student or teacher and a sangha. This is Rebecca Solnit speaking about listening, seeing others. Equality keeps us honest. Our peers tell us who we are and how we're doing. Providing the service in personal life that a free press does in a functioning society. Inequality creates liars and delusion. The powerless need to dissemble. That's how slaves, servants, and women got the reputation of being liars. And the powerful grow stupid on the lies they require from their subordinates. and on the lack of need to know about others who are nobody, who don't count, who've been silenced or trained to please. This is why I always pair privilege with obliviousness. Obliviousness is privilege's form of deprivation. When you don't hear others, you don't imagine them, they become unreal, and you're left in a wasteland of a world with only yourself in it, and that surely makes you starving, though you know not for what, if you've ceased to imagine others exist in any true, deep way that matters. This is about a need for which we hardly have language, or at least not a familiar conversation. Sila, the role of Sila in our interpersonal lives. Samadhi, and here I'm speaking less about samadhi as the pure unification of the mind, but as a kind of agility, flexibility, fluidity, its role in our interpersonal lives. So in deep conditioning, in the zones of really patterned behavior, it's just like a fog, this vague fog coming over my mind. And somehow it's like all of a sudden into that habit of that conditioning, it's like I just can't see 10 feet in front of me, like being fogged in. And the Dharma is like this very distant echo. And often in our deepest kind of like the zones of real habit, the zones where the Dharma is not penetrated, it's like there's often a very, there's an energy that's cycling, but it's not, it definitely doesn't feel so piercing. It's like a little, it's intense and subtle. It's hard to grasp it, you know? It's like sometimes you have an experience and it's just like, oh, a piercing pain. That is grief right there, yeah? But in some of our zones of compulsivity, there's really like this just, it's just foggy, vague, and energy cycling through, sometimes coating the whole body. But it's like we can't get the awareness around it, yeah? It's elusive in ways. And it keeps kicking us back more and more deeply into story, yeah? And story, it can be like almost like a kind of like a black hole. You know, a black hole is a region of space-time exhibiting such strong gravitational effects that nothing, not even particles and electromagnetic radiation such as light, can escape from inside it. The boundary of the region from which no escape is possible is called the event horizon. Although the event horizon has an enormous effect on the fate of an object crossing it, no locally detectable features appear to be observed. Story. Yeah. The kind of gravitational pull of story, in the zones of deep conditioning, of real habit, of real compulsion, it's like a black hole. Yeah. And the capacity to actually stay with phenomena, to stay with sensory experience as experience, rather than narrating it, that takes a certain kind of like mind strength, because that gravity is strong. It's strong. It's like, okay, we're with the body, we're with the kind of emotional experience as it's, and it just like the gravity just pulling, you know. And maybe we touch in for a moment, but we actually have to soak in. Max said vitaka vichara, like to connect and sustain, aim and penetrate. And the body is not penetrated by the awareness. It's like glancing off. Yeah. And so we want to see that the story is both getting us into trouble, and there's usually something soothing about it. The story is somehow taking the edge off something. Yeah. How is that functioning? Can I stay? This is a mind training skill. Can I stay? Story, our thoughts are begging us to think them, begging us, yeah? And we stay. We train for this on the cushion. We train when we want to get up. We train when we want to itch. We train when we want to move. We train when we don't want to sit. This is all a kind of a training ground for when we can't move, yeah? And the last feature that feels relevant is the actually detecting the subtleties of our mind states. You know, as we develop samadhi, as we develop this steadiness of looking, we start to perceive more and, you know, more wispy experiences in us, yeah? It's like, oh, that's just a very faint breath of fear, yeah? But knowing that can change everything, yeah? It's like in our meetings, in our practice discussions, I'm really trying to listen to like the subtle murmurs in me, the way I'm impacted by you, so that I might respond in a way that's more helpful. And maybe there's something coming up that's dominant, but then what else is there? What can I trust in here? And the more we actually have a kind of full picture of all that's being evoked in body and mind, the more we can navigate skillfully. Yeah. And just to know it is often enough to inform the path forward. Panya wisdom. So how do we as adults play, you know? I think we play through heart connections, through relating in a way that is undisguised, unashamed of need, of desire, unashamed of our inner life, and a kind of loosening of this self-curation, manicuring the self, kind of performing our identity. Ajahn Sajito said, You know, he said we're so like embroiled in our personality, and so often the interactions are like, are they kind of ego to ego, personality to personality? And he used a word to describe that realm that I was kind of struck by. He said, like the ordinary social discourse, which is kind of just so alienated from the heart, he described it as eerie. Yeah? It's like, well, hello, my name's Matthew. Yeah. Or some equivalent, you know, of just like that. That's not going to come out on the recording. Sorry, folks. Yeah. But the difference between that kind of like performing an identity and just, relaxing some of the self-view is the difference between connection being like deeply nourishing or not. You know, like the ego-to-ego contact is not nourishing. Yeah? It's like, it's alienating, you know? So, this not clinging to self-view, not fixating the self as this and that and all the moralism of I'm this, I'm not that, you know, like all of that, it actually allows us to express our personalities more fully. Like it's not an accident that as people, you know, teachers, meditation teachers, they usually have like, you can feel their personality, right? And it's coming through, you know, it's coming through in this kind of unfiltered way, unfettered in a way, yeah? Not constricted by the kind of dampening effects of self-clinging. And so this kind of, you know, it said like the sense of self is felt as tension. Sense of self is felt as tension. And the ease, the kind of looseness that opens up in the interpersonal sphere as we cling less is a delight. I love it when people make fun of me. Like nice people, but but really make fun of me. Like you can feel the love in it and they're really making fun of me, you know. And it fills it does delight me because it's like this way of playing with the conventions of self, this kind of like fluid, flexible play with identity, yeah. And if we've drained some of the emotional charge from who we think we are, that becomes all play. Because there's actually nothing at stake. There's nothing to protect. There's nothing that I need to curate and manicure and tend to. It's like, yeah, I have problems. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's fun. The Buddha says, like, don't disparage yourself in Dharma talks. I've ignored that advice for some years, but it's It's play. It's playing with I amness. Yeah. Now it is intense in this sphere because there's nothing like the gaze of the other to evoke the sense of self. Yeah. Right? We there are very prescribed ways in which you can gaze into another's eyes. And mostly it's between a parent and child or lovers and any other couple, any other pairing. There's bandwidth for about 3 seconds of eye gazing, and then someone's going to start talking about the weather. Yeah. Right? Yeah, it's just like you can feel, it's very instructive. You can just feel the self constellating. Yeah. Oh, that tension. Oh, that sort of we're looking, but then we're being looked upon. And what are we seeing in their, how are they seeing us? What do we see in their mind? We are imagining them, imagine us. Yeah. And it can get tight. Yeah. Right. This is maybe self at its peak. Yeah. And then we learn to relax. Yeah. To not stand guard at the gates of our self-image, but just to be seen and to see, like Max was talking about with Abramovich. To see and be seen and not need to control what we think they see. And in that dissolution, in that melting away of the sense of I'm being looked at, something, me, in that dissolution there is the possibilities for deeper and deeper connection. The ways this egoic constriction, it compromises our own delight, but it also has effects on others. It leaks out, you know, our own egoic pressure leaks out. And so a lot of what we call social skills is tap dancing to avoid the egoic soft spots of the other. Yeah? Like to the extent that I am insistent on this is what I am, it requires accommodations from you. Yeah? If I need to be a good meditation teacher, that's a trip I'm laying on you. Yeah. Because then you have to navigate my sensitivity. Yeah. And so the more free we can become with this, the more we actually free up other people. Yeah. The more they can start to find their own way with us, actually be like free to experience themselves there rather than to be navigating our sensitivity. So this is a gift we give to others. Shuangzu says, if a man's crossing a river and an empty boat collides with his own skiff, even though he be a bad-tempered man, he will not become very angry. But if he sees a man in the boat, he'll shout at him to steer clear. If the shout's not heard, he'll shout again and yet again and begin cursing. And all because there is somebody in the boat. Yet if the boat were empty, he would not be shouting and not be angry. If you can empty your own boat crossing the river of the world, no one will oppose you. No one will seek to harm you. So, lastly, it's teaching on self, anatta, fluid self, not self, no self. One side of it is not self, well, the other side we could say not other. In the same way that we freeze our own being into something, into a list of yeses and nos, we do that to others. Yeah. And Ajahn Sumedho was asked by a student, like how... Actually, it was a nun returning to her family after having taken robes, and she was still in robes but was going to visit for holiday, I believe. And she was asked, like, how do I be kind to them? Like, there was a sense of, I don't know the story, but the whole kind of backlog of, you know, it was going to be a difficult family time. And his advice to her, the way to be kind was not to create them. Don't create them. Yeah. It's a very beautiful way of saying, do not freeze their being into a noun. Yeah. We try to hang our love and hate on the kind of coat hook at the center of the other's being. Yeah? But it's not there. Yeah? We can know someone so well, love someone so deeply, and still... appreciate the non-fixation of a being, not make them someone, yeah? And that's how we stay open and keep staying open. Psychiatrist Kernberg said, love is the revelation of the other person's freedom. Love is the revelation of the other person's freedom. And there's something about that that fills me with, like, yeah, just kind of wonder and reverence and letting go. But we can actually love even more deeply. We can love others more deeply. Gil said something like, Don't quote me on this because I may be bungling this. Something like, in awakening, it's not you that gets free. You free everything else. Sit for a moment. May our development of Sila Samadhi Panya, may this be a blessing in our lives. Leading to more and more wisdom, love. For ourselves. For those in our lives. May we use this realm to grow. To let go, to love more deeply. To enjoy the blessings of others.